Hello, I'm Barbara Sullivan. The Big Anxiety. This is a festival of people plus arts plus science, which brings together artists, scientists and communities to question and reimagine the state of mental health in the 21st century. It explores how art and art experiences can provide new perspectives on the scientific and biomedical view and approaches to health. In this interview series for the Big Anxiety Festival, we're talking to different creative people about their mental health and their creative lives and how these things come together. One of the topics explored through the Big Anxiety Festival is that of ageing and the individual and societal strategies for coping. Today I'll be discussing this by phone with the Ambassador for the Ageing Program at the Big Anxiety, the inimitable Sandra Pankhurst. Sandra's well known through the highly successful book about her life, The Trauma Cleaner, written by Sarah Krasnostein. As a personality, they certainly broke the mould with Sandra. She is truly a wonderful example of how a transgender person can transform decades of traumatic experiences into a productive and purposeful life. Hello, Sandra.
Good afternoon, Barbara. How are you?
Very well. And you're down in Melbourne. It's great to have you on the phone.
It's my pleasure to be with you too.
Now, if ever there was an ambassador who could draw on their own experience to help others, it's you. How do you
Thank
see
you.
Your role in the festival as an ambassador?
Look, because I'm ageing myself and I see the health issues and things involved and I'm terminal with my lung condition and it's managing that and managing what I'm going to do. Sure, I'd like to be able to stay at home as long as I possibly can, and that would be my biggest desire, because I think going into a nursing home or some sort of hospice would be a very scary experience. And I think it's something we need to make sure that we can get the proper protocols put in place that everyone, regardless of their gender or whatever, are looked after and treated with respect, because the catch cry for my business is care, compassion and dignity. And I really think that care, compassion and dignity should be put into the aged care system.
Let's talk about your own experience. We'll just go right back to little Peter, your young self. And you faced difficulties from the very start. Tell us about that early period as an adopted child.
As an adopted child, all you ever know is that you just want to be loved. So I couldn't understand why I was not loved. And at the age of 7, I was told that I was no longer wanted. Surprisingly enough, today, one of my trips into the city was to find out the history of my adoption, which was all clouded under this mystique, and there were certain stories going around that now I know are untrue. And I found out who my real mother is, and she was an unmarried woman, and hopefully now through an organisation called Vanish that we can find out and see whether this person is still alive and whether or not she would like to make contact. So it's been a really invigorating morning for me to find out my true roots and where I belong.
That is fascinating that it has taken all this time to get to that stage. Have you had a desire to track down your biological parents before?
Actually, no, for the simple reason that all I ever wanted was to be loved by the first set of parents that I knew. And when that was not a successful venture, I thought, how can I possibly expect anyone else to love me? So it was never on my radar, and I've had several friends over the years say to me, why don't you look for your real parents? And no, I don't have an interest. And especially now that I've transitioned, how are they knocking at the door and going, oh, hello, I'm your son? They'd have a bloody heart attack, and then I'd be up for manslaughter. So, you know, I just sort of think, no, it was not the right thing to do. But now, as things go on, Vanish can make that organisation who Julia Gillard set up when she was Prime Minister of Australia, and I thank her for that. And so, with another organisation called Find, they do all the legal background. Well, that's who I had the meeting with this morning. So they've given me all the paperwork, court documents, everything, which puts a whole new slant on things. And now I need to go back to Vanish, show them the paperwork that I've got so that they can then take it further and see whether or not this woman is interested in wanting to catch up with me or even whether she's still alive.
So during those years where you had that awful, abusive adoptive parents, did you ever suffer from an identity confusion? You know, I understand that genetic mirroring is an important stage in childhood development that adopted children miss out on.
Look, I don't really know the answer to that question because I was a very confused child. But one of the things that I found out through Vanish is the adoption rate of children, there's a very high percentage of those children that transition, which absolutely blew my mind.
Fascinating.
How could this be? So I would really like to look into that further. And I'm becoming a fundraiser for the organisation Vanish because they desperately need funds to keep their work up. Other people need to know that they can go and check because maybe, you know, this woman that's still alive, and I don't want to go in and give her name just yet because it could be a freak out for her if she heard this on radio or something like that. And I think I owe her the dignity to see whether she wants to make contact first. And I just think that people knowing that now the rules have changed, that they can make contact if they want to, it's very valuable. It's a really ingratiating tool to sort of help you navigate where your past has come from.
For that era when you were growing up, you took charge of your life early on, deciding to live as a transgender woman. I know you got married and you had a son.
Two children, 9 months and a week apart, which is a bit like a rabbit those days.
But did it greatly relieve your anxiety or increase it?
It increased my anxiety because as the second child came along, I realised I was not in the right situation for me and I could quite easily, and I'm ashamed to say this, become a child basher. I knew then that I had to leave the situation. It was out of my control. I couldn't cope with it. And then I got onto the gay scene. I never ever thought of myself as gay. I thought I was effeminate, but I never thought of myself as gay because I couldn't cope with two men or two women together or anything. I remember my first experience going out to a gay bar, and I hadn't been out for years, and I rocked up at this place called the Dover Hotel in Carlton, and I turn up at 6 o'clock at night. And so as I go upstairs into this first foyer, you go into a second foyer, and then the bar staff are the only ones that are there. And I thought, oh, dear, this is not a busy place. And they turned around and said to me, oh, you're new, aren't you? I said, yes, I am. They said, oh, we don't open until 10:30, 11 o'clock. I thought, oh, okay. So I went downtown and coffeed myself to death till I come back. When I come back, as I went up the stairs and got through the first foyer into the second foyer, the look on my face must have been priceless because there was a table not far to the left of me. And they said to me, oh, you're new here, aren't you? And they said, come and sit with us and we'll make you feel comfortable and relaxed and all that. Well, I become friends with them. And it was only through becoming friends with them that I sort of got involved in the gay scene. But it was never really my cup of tea. You know, I didn't know what I was. But it was only overhearing conversations that transgender people actually existed, that you could have medication, you could do this. It was like a light bulb went off in my head. So I then pursued looking for a doctor to find to get hormones and all that sort of stuff. And life went on from there because, like, I'd even seen drag shows, but the breast jobs in those days, they were rock hard. And, like, and I thought all that there was plastic, like with a choker around the neck because everyone had a choker on. And little did I know that you could have breast surgically enhanced and you could have a myriad of different things done. So it was a very eye-opening experience, and you know, and I have no regrets in what I've done right through my experience of transitioning. But I'm sort of a little bit concerned about the younger transgender people because there's such a high suicide rate. How can a child at 4 or 5 understand what's involved in transitioning? If you think it's going to bring you love or happiness or the picket fence and all this, you're daydreaming. Really, all it does is make your body feel more comfortable, but it doesn't change anything else. You have the same problems as Mr. and Mrs. Average have. We've still got to navigate life. We've still got to navigate work. We've still got to navigate our experiences in life. So I don't think that explained enough to the younger transgender people, and I worry for our future. And I'm also a bit of a believer that we are what we eat, and everything we have now is either genetically modified or hormone pounced. And I think, is this what's happening? And is there too much information out there? But then how does a child at 4 or 5 go, I want to cut my penis off? I don't comprehend that.
So when you were transitioning, did you feel that the only options for you were to spend life as a drag queen and a sex worker?
Did you initially, I did, until I realised that you could do this in a bigger and better way. And it was only by having a relationship with a chap that is now deceased. And he said to me, Sandra, he said, look, you know, when you're with all your gay friends, he said, you act very gay. He said, if you really want to be a woman, he said, you need to be with normal people and women. And I took that as actually really good advice. And it sort of led me steady into the life that I have now, that I have no paranoias, I have no fears, I'm accepted in the community, and I spent my whole life really just focusing on work with a driven mind. It's only since the book came out that I've actually started to learn to accept myself for myself. So the book has been very cathartic to me to make me realise that, you know, I'm not such a bad person after all. In fact, I quite like Sandra. It's been a good experience for me to have the book done.
Well, that brings us to your career, The Trauma Cleaner, which is, I guess, one of the main focuses of the book. You were focused on your career and you've built a very successful trauma cleaning company.
Yes.
Could you talk about that transformative period of your life?
It was sort of out of a matter of adversity, really, because my husband at the time, because I ended up getting married, which was illegal in those days, so I got married on a passport, but we took the gamble, we did it, and all that sort of stuff. He was the director of Mackay Rubber. And so he wanted me to travel with him, you know, as he was wheeling and dealing and doing business around the world. That was all fine and well. But, like, getting to tell him about my situation so that we could get married was another ballgame, because we'd lived together for 6 months prior to him knowing anything about me and he wanting then to marry me. And so I said to him, look, I really have to talk to my doctor about this. Oh, you're not dying, are you? I said, no, I'm not dying. But I need to talk to my doctor before I can confirm anything with you. Anyhow, I went to my doctor and I said, what do I do? How do I tell this guy that I'm a sex change? He said, well, don't ever tell him you're a sex change. Tell him you're transgender. He said, it's a softer way. And men sort of can relate a little bit better with that. Anyhow, we left the surgery. We went to my favourite spot. I had this place where I used to sit and calm and look at the water, and that was my chill-out place. As soon as we got there, it was like, come on, tell me. And I said, well, George, you know, how I am perceived is not how I was really come about. Oh, you don't want to be a lesbian, do you? I said, no, that's not the case at all. George, I said, I had to be surgically enhanced to become the person I am now, but I weren't always this person. And it went deadly silent. And I was sort of half expecting to be smacked in the mouth or something, which had happened on other occasions. But no, it was very calm. But he was an older gentleman too, and very, very respectful. He was a gorgeous person. Anyhow, he turned around, and like, it might have been a minute or something like that, and impatient Sandra goes, well? And he said to me, well, I met Sandra. I fell in love with Sandra, and I'm going to marry Sandra. And it was like this
weight
was taken off my shoulders. And he was the perfect gentleman. You'd walk down the street, he'd be on the outside of the curbside. He would open the car door. He'd always pull your chair out for you. He was so respectful. It was like a fantasy land. Where could I get all this respect from after the background that I'd had in my previous life?
You deserved George. You earned George.
Well, I've got a funny experience I can tell you about that, because I used to be a funeral director prior to that. And he came to me because his wife had died. And so people used to say to me, how did you meet George? And I'd clap my hands and go, buried his wife. But it was a joke. But in actual fact, it was the truth.
So how did you get into the trauma cleaning business?
We then bought a hardware store together in Brighton. I was sort of busy running that with him. I was on 13 different committees. I was running for local government, on the Lady Mayoress's committee, and all sorts of things. But then George wanted me for himself. I said, well, George, what were you doing when you were 40? You were whining and dining, travelling the world, wheeling and dealing. Give me the opportunity now to have these experiences for me. He didn't like it, but he allowed it, and things went on. But then Bunnings come along. We had $250,000 in rent before outgoings, and it became tough, Becky. So regardless of how well-known I was, and everyone used to come into the shop and chinwag and chat and everything, we couldn't live on nickels and dimes. So we called the liquidators in, closed the business down, and then I had to reinvent myself. Well, the press were very good to me, and I started a domestic cleaning business. And because I kept every job that I did, people go, this looks absolutely fabulous. So I registered a business called We're Absolutely Fabulous. And my catch cry was, if you need a cleaner, remember, we're absolutely fabulous. Well, within 3 months, I had 20 staff, and in those days, you didn't have to pay for staff to work between jobs. You only paid them for the job at hand, each
yes.
one. So out of an 8-hour day, they could only earn 6 hours of money. And so they'd be forever ringing up, Johnny's sick, I'm not coming in, I've got a headache, or I'm premenstrual, or something or other. And you'd have all this work. Well, I was working like a crazy person around the clock, plus all the committees and things and like that that I was on. In the end, I thought, there's got to be an easier way. So I contacted a friend of mine through the funeral industry. We got a job straight away. And what a major learning curve that was. Because I had a laboratory technician background, so I studied into the chemicals and things that were needed, and subsequently went on our way from there. But the first job was such a challenge, because I was always known as Mrs. Squeaky Clean. Mrs. Sparkle. To go to a rat-infested hoarding situation was like mind-blowing to me. I couldn't believe people could live like this. So I then realised that this task was a lot more difficult than I thought. So I researched more, had to come to terms with the fact that this is what I'd chosen to do, but it was going to give me more financial return. So subsequently today, we have the biggest privately owned trauma cleaning company in Victoria.
And trauma cleaning includes hoarders
hoarding,
and
squalor, mess labs, odour control, sewage cleanups, vomits, all the jobs that no one else wants, really. And we've got a specialist name in hoarding because we're very, very good at looking after people with mental health, ABIs, drug and alcohol issues, and grieving. So we've done very well for ourselves.
And it's those attributes that you have brought to this very essential but difficult business that you feel makes you stand out.
Yeah, and I employ people too that have been from the School of Hard Knocks, because they are far more compassionate and understanding, having a story of their own. And I constantly get the feedback from clients that, oh, your staff are fantastic. And I go, yeah, I know. They're absolutely brilliant. I love my staff. I've just recently been in hospital for a month. That's the first time ever I've been in hospital and not had to run the business from my mobile phone. As a consequence of that, I'm taking all the staff and their partners out for lunch to a swanky little restaurant so they can have a good time as a thank you for them for looking after my best interests while I was away and giving me the chance to heal.
After your life of shocking abuse, does the trauma cleaning business, which exposes you to all the things you've talked about, the extreme loneliness and depression and anxiety that's behind the hoarding problem, does it help you cope with your own emotional scars?
It makes me realise that I'm not the only one, and like, it could be me tomorrow, because a lot of it is the straw that broke the camel's back. And we go in there and you see plaques on the walls of our managing director of this company. They were on the board of directors of a certain hospital, or they're high profile people, and there's no particular demographics, so
yes.
We don't judge anyone. We're not there to tell you how to live, we're there to help you through the process to get a better life. And subsequently, one in particular client that was really uptight about getting her place clean, and it took quite some time to be able to get access to the property. When we got halfway through the property, we could see the black mould was so intense in the property, we had to shut the job down. She ended up absolutely furious and ended up getting put into aged care. But 6 months later, she'd contacted the people that were helping her through this process and said, you know, that's the best experience I've ever had. She said, I thought I was dying. She said, now I feel like I've got life again. Because she didn't know how to handle that she'd had a sewage overflow and there was plumbing issues and water was leaking everywhere and she had all this trash everywhere. And then the black mould, which was actually trying to kill her at the time, she realised in hindsight, thank you God that someone come to my rescue. And that's the enjoyment I get out of my work, changing people's lives, helping people through the next transition to a better life. Some are grateful, some are not grateful.
Yes, it's really beneficial for a society like ours that is evolving to become more inclusive, that you're using all that experience to become a vocal advocate for aged care rights and mental health. How do you view the current offering of aged care sector services?
I think it needs a lot of education. I think we need to start looking at treating people like human beings, not as a number and not as a cash roll for a particular organisation or whatever. I think we need to have a lot of education in treating people with respect. When you see through the Royal Commission now some of the things that are going on, it's just mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing what's going on. And I think we need to have an education program and maybe a psychological test to see whether you're suited for this particular type of work in the first place. Because a lot of the people that come, it's the bottom of the line job, it doesn't pay very good money, and they're in it because it's either that or what am I going to be on the dole or something like that. So I think we need to be a little bit more particular. We probably need to pay them a bit more money too, but we need to educate them in the fine arts of treating people with respect. Respect is the biggest thing that I think our community is lacking, and a lot of it is brought about by these bureaucrats that are sort of, you can't discipline people, you can't do this. Well, we've got a society that's going bloody crazy. So we need to bring discipline back in. As a child, you need boundaries to know how far you can push, and it never hurt us to get a clip over the ear when we were younger and say, now listen here. You know, but these days they're cotton wool, and the anxiety that the kids suffer because they haven't had to deal with anything, or they have their first love and it falls apart and they want to kill themselves. Toughen up. You know, you need to realise that life is not always going to be easy, but out of every bad experience, a good one will follow. So you just need to be looking at the half glass full rather than the glass half empty.
And also, I think in aged care, it's very binary, isn't it? I don't know, they just seem to cater for what they consider to be the heterosexual unit. There's a great need to look beyond that.
Get it out now, because of the marriage equity and all that sort of thing now, and the LGB is so out there, which I'm not really into. As I said, I think I might have said to you before that I'm not into pronouns and all this. It's just a matter of how would you like to be treated? How would you like to be addressed? That to me is more respectful than worrying about a pronoun or we're going to offend somebody. Stop the crap and just take it back to basics and treat people as you want to be treated in return.
Well, there's a very interesting event that's happening at the Big Anxiety that I think strikes a particular chord with you, and that's the screening of the film Becoming Colleen.
Oh, amazing.
Would you like to talk about the film Becoming Colleen and what it is that makes that just struck a nerve with you?
Well, Colleen wanted to transition when she was about 40, and she was married, had two children, a similar story to myself, to be honest, but I transitioned much earlier than her. Anyhow, Colleen's another 20 years older than I am. Anyhow, it was hard for her to deal with all this, but the wife realised when they were around 40 that Colleen wanted to dress up and all that, and so she allowed it in their privacy, and they'd go on cruises and things and they'd dress up and all this sort of stuff, and Colleen felt more complete in herself. But then, unfortunately, Heather died of a brain tumour, and they'd already lost one son through drugs. So it was a very sad life. And then Colleen wanted to transition, but around 82. Wanting to transition at 82, which was very challenging. And then Colleen became quite ill, and then she had to go into care. And they were learning how to deal with her, and also the other residents there, also having to come to terms with this unusual person that was in there. Well, I have a problem with that we should be more open and more receptive to the human being rather than the human presence, you know, that what we picture is how we're going to judge you. You and I and everyone else has no right to judge anybody. Colleen ended up passing away at 85, never got to fulfil her dream. I was then asked whether I would be the spokesperson for the movie, which has been really amazing to do, and there's been several Q&As. We've won all the awards for it, the official launch and the Sydney Film Festival, the Melbourne Film Festival, the Human Rights Film Festival. So I do hope that Ian, the producer, does get it to be an educational aid to help people through and get it into nursing homes and even schools of learning tolerance and acceptance and understanding of other people that might be a bit different to you. We pick on people for their colour, now we're picking on people for their gender. Let people be people. it sort of struck a chord with me because there was so much there that it's made me really passionate that I want to be involved in the educational side of things or be on a board that says, this is how we should be doing things from my perspective. And then other people on the board sort of go, well, this is how I see it. We make up a jigsaw puzzle of how we feel the best interest of everyone in the situation is going to be looked after without prejudice or indifference.
And so how do you think society can benefit from the Big Anxiety Ageing Program? There are a few events on.
Yes, there are a few events on, but I think listening to different stories of people that, one, are ageing, two, that have had a plethora of different experiences in life, can only help them understand a little bit more and maybe help put a few pieces together. When I was first asked to do the Anxiety Festival, a little joke I had with Natasha was that what I have to do is sit on the end of bed and shake. And she said, I find it weird that you call it the Big Anxiety Festival. It should be the Big Anti-Anxiety Festival. And she said, well, this is the name that it's got and it's been like this for years, blah, blah, blah. I said, oh, I just find it a little bit weird, but never mind. But I was very thrilled that I'd been actually asked to speak at the festival and to be an ambassador, because like I'll push every barrel I can to make sure that respect, we bring respect back. We have to have respect, we have to have discipline, we have to have care for other people, care, compassion, dignity. These are all the things that I thrive for in life, because no one deserves to suffer or feel misplaced or misunderstood.
Well, you're certainly going about it the right way, Sandra. You're using your, when I say notoriety, I mean that in a very positive way. You're using your high profile to excellent effect. And I think as an ambassador, you'll be so involved in what's happening with the Big Anxiety Program that people will be attracted to it.
Well, I hope they are attracted, because it's put on for a reason, and it's there to help people navigate through their experience of ageing and what to expect and how to deal with it and all that. Because, you know, really, if we knew younger what we're going to go through when we age, we'd probably book out younger. You know what I mean? Because we don't know what tomorrow's going to bring, and there's so much uncertainty there. But we need to look at it in a positive light and listen to other people's experiences and maybe realise that we're not so bad off after all. You know, life is not such a bitchy experience. It's actually better than I thought. There's a lot of people worse off than I am. So I hope people flock to the festival in bathe, that they are very happy with the outcome and they learn something. You know, and I know that I'll certainly be hanging around, so if people want to personally talk to me, I'm not backward in coming forward, and, you know, I could talk the hind leg off a chair. So if people want to come up and have a chin wag or have a chat or whatever, please feel free to do so, because that's what we're there for. We're there to alleviate some of the pressures and the anxiety that you might feel about ageing or what the future might hold for you.
And Sandra, before we finish, I must say that I absolutely loved your book.
It's the sixth most read book in Australia, and there's talk of film, a serial being done on in America. We're just negotiating. I'm excited that, yes, I've had all this experience with being a trauma cleaner and hoarding and mental health and drug and alcohol and everything like that for this last 26 years. But I feel like now that I'm reinventing myself as a public speaker, and I'm sort of getting asked to speak everywhere.
Well, Sandra, it's wonderful talking to you today, and thank you so much for your time. It's a very positive story, yours, and I wish you all the success.
And I appreciate the fact that you're interviewing me, and thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners.
And that was Sandra Pankhurst, indeed one of a kind. Sandra is the Ambassador for Ageing at the Big Anxiety Festival. And you can find the full program on the website, thebiganxiety.org. We will be posting this 8-segment series on the Big Anxiety, featuring artists and ambassadors in conversation with Beck Dean, curator of the festival, and me, Barbara Sullivan, from Radio 2RPH.